Hi everyone. So I just wanted to start today's podcast by letting you know that we have Get Doper as our sponsor of today's episode. Now you probably heard me talk about Get Doper quite a bit on the podcast over the past few months. And that is because I've been taking this supplement now for probably 6 months and I really believe in it. I believe that it works. And that's why I keep asking them to come back and sponsor the podcast because I'm hearing from you guys that it's also working as well. So I wanted to let you know that Get Doper is 3 capsules taken once a day. So you take them and then it's done. They are a nutritional supplement created by an ADHD founder purely because he knew what was desperately needed to help him as a neurodivergent individual. So Get Doper includes 16 high quality bioavailable ingredients that support our mental performance, mood, focus, energy, and our brain health. And they also work to support the neurotransmitters, which are the building blocks to dopamine, and strengthen, very importantly, our central nervous system, something that I talk about a huge amount on the podcast. So I know that I'm hearing from many of you guys who are using the discount code, which is Kate10, to get 10% off. And that you're telling me how effective Get Doper has been, which is why I keep reinforcing it back as a sponsor. But it's also been backed by clinical experts, by ADHD experts, such as Dr. Rachel Gow and Sarah Osborne, who know that these ingredients are fantastic for the ADHD brain and the nervous system. So we've got 10% discount. Use the code KATE10. It's getdoper.com, or head to the show notes. You'll see all the information there and the link to get the discount. Now let's get started with today's podcast. Welcome to the ADHD Women's Wellbeing Podcast. I'm Kate Moore Youssef, and I'm a wellbeing and lifestyle coach, EFT practitioner, mum to 4 kids, and passionate about helping more women to understand and accept their amazing ADHD brains. After speaking to many women just like me, and probably you, I know there is a need for more health and lifestyle support for women newly diagnosed with ADHD. In these conversations, you'll learn from insightful guests, hear new findings, and discover powerful perspectives and lifestyle tools to enable you to live your most fulfilled, calm, and purposeful life wherever you are on your ADHD journey. Here's today's episode. Today, we are talking all about the power of the brain. We're talking about neuroscience, neuroplasticity, and we have the most amazing guest. Her name is Nicole Vignola. She is a neuroscientist. She's a corporate consultant and a brain performance coach. And she has a BSc in neuroscience and an MSc in organizational psychology. And Nicole works with all different companies and individuals worldwide, educating them on the science of human optimization, health, and longevity. And I'm just absolutely delighted to have Nicole here. She's got a brand new book out called Rewire, and it's fascinating. And we're going to be talking all about neuroscience and ADHD. We're really going to be looking at it through the lens of neurodivergence. And I think we've got a lot to talk about. So Nicole, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so excited for you. You've got an amazing book that is being released on the 9th of May here in the UK, but I presume it's available, you know, worldwide.
Yes. So it's being released in the US on the 4th of June. But yes, okay, it is available worldwide. So.
And from what I understand, you're bringing neuroscience to the masses. You're simplifying a lot of complicated information and helping us really understand how we can optimize our own brain so we can thrive, enjoy life, succeed.
Absolutely. So I did my BSc in neuroscience, and I had a bit of an existential crisis when I graduated because I didn't want to work in the lab. And then it kind of hit me that I wanted to make neuroscience tangible for people. So that's why I went into organizational psychology. I wanted to go into corporations and teach them the science as to why all these things that they're discussing, like sleep, meditation, you know, they've put those little placards in the bathrooms from HR, and everyone kind of scoffs at them going, ugh. And as soon as I'd come in and explain the science, you could kind of see, you know, the penny drop for most people going, oh, I get it now. I understand. It's not just, you know, woo-woo stuff that HR is forcing me to do. It actually is grounded in mechanisms. So, yeah.
What you just said then is actually an interesting segue into something I wanted to talk about. And is on the podcast, I talk a huge amount about lifestyle interventions, holistic care, anything well-being. And that was the reason why I started the podcast, is that you know, from a very early stage of understanding ADHD, it was always medicalized, and the only option was you need to take a stimulant, or you need to, you know, it's a pharmaceutical option. And actually what I'd noticed before I was diagnosed, I was trying to help myself and optimize, I guess, my own brain and nervous system through lifestyle and holistic, you know, care. But it was also through things like self-talk, walking, it was regulating my own nervous system. But I didn't quite have the, I guess, the science backing behind it. And it just kind of was a bit of a mishmash of different things that I'd created for myself, because I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand it was my ADHD almost taking control of me. And so would you say, you know, we talk about things now about like gratitude, journaling, meditation, walking, breathing, creating space for our thoughts. Are there science, neuroscientific backings now and research to say that this is actually the way forward?
Yes, absolutely. I've spoken loads about it in my book, but gratitude as an example is, it's a positive feedback loop. The more grateful you are for things, the more you feel good about yourself. And then the more you feel good, the more you start to see the light on all the other good things in your life. Now, we have a negativity bias as humans, which means that we tend to dwell on all the things that we haven't got yet, or all the things that have gone wrong, all the things in our week that have been rubbish compared to the small things that maybe have gone well. And it's interesting because when I talk to clients and I'll say, what are the small wins and the big wins of your week? They'll say, oh, well, not much, actually. And as we get chatting, I go, oh, that's a small win. And they go, oh, yeah. And then by the end of the conversation, they're sort of saying, oh my gosh, I actually had an amazing week. And you could see the shift in all, because our brains have selective attention, right? So you're not bringing in all the information that you're seeing right now in the periphery. I know I've got a white background, but there'll be background noise. I can see in my background, there's a window. I don't know what's in your background, but those images are still coming in through your eyes. You're just filtering those out to say, Nicole is important right now. Her voice is important, but that information is still there. And the thing is, when we focus on the negative things in our life, we only then see the negative things that happen to us in our day rather than all the positive things. And that is, you know, down to evolution, but we can change that narrative. We can change that focus and say, okay, yes, today was probably not great. And I had a day like that the other day where I just actually wanted to be a bit moody and focus on all the bad things. And that was, but what's the majority of your life? Is it mostly negative, or is it mostly sort of trying to find gratitude, trying to find sort of positivity in your day? And it's important to not slap that with a toxic kind of positive paintbrush, you know, but more like a realistic outlook on your day.
So can I ask, you talk about this, and I know with the default mode network, it's something that's been talked quite a lot about in ADHD right now. That there's this understanding that we've got the default mode network, and I'm probably going to just butcher this, but from what I understand from my very basic level is that is the bias that where we can ruminate and worry, and it's sort of the negative things that sort of come in. And with ADHD, what I think neuroscientists have spotted is that we are more prone to a more sort of powerful DMN, and we have to reactivate our TPN, which is the task positive network. And we have to, and I guess that's sort of neuroplasticity, isn't it? We do things through gratitude and through noticing those small wins and noticing the little things and the appreciating the little things that have happened. And I don't know if you're aware of Dr. Ned Halliwell. He's at the forefront of ADHD, and he has been for many, many years. And he said that the most profound sort of discovery now with ADHD and helping his clients and his patients is for them to understand the DMN and why we have this in our brain and why we're more prone to this being kind of like the driving force. So could you speak a little bit about how we can activate the TPN a little bit more and kind of suppress the DMN?
Yes. I love that you've mentioned that, and it is the forefront of science. And it's so let me just give you a little bit of a background on the DMN and the TPN, or which the TPN falls within the central executive network, which is responsible for decision making, problem solving, etc. But just to backtrack a little bit, the default mode network resides in a big area of the brain, and it's essentially what the name says, default mode of thinking. So what are you thinking about when you're not really thinking about anything? Now, the DMN is responsible for rumination, internal wondering, but also responsible for autobiographical memories, but also creativity. Now, whichever way it has been wired is what's going to dominate. So the way that I explain it is the default mode network is like a garden. And if you allow it to overgrow with weeds, it will override everything. It will kind of be like a negative place that you don't want to go into. And that's that typical feeling of, I don't want to sit alone with my thoughts, so I'm just going to keep myself super busy so I don't have to deal with that. The problem with that is that you get into bed at night and that's when all those thoughts start arising and you're going, oh my goodness, now I can't sleep. So the more time we spend in the DMN and cultivate a positive garden, if you will, pull out the weeds and plant the flower beds with gratitude and all the wonderful things you mentioned, then we can wire this place to be a comfortable place of quote unquote happiness and maybe even creativity. It should be a wonderful place of mind wandering. When we're children, it's more active in a creative and imaginative way. I don't know if you can resonate with that, but I do recall having times where I'd come home and just daydream on my bed, which I don't do ever anymore. And now the central executive network, or the task positive network, responsible for more outward thinking tasks. So what you're probably active in right now. Now, from my understanding, there's sometimes an asynchrony in the way that these two networks fire, which means that they overlap when they perhaps shouldn't, or one comes on when the other one shouldn't be on, etc. So that's when you get kind of like attention redirection when you're supposed to be doing a task at hand, particularly if you find it boring. Now, we can actually strengthen the central executive network through things like meditation, which can help you actually change the connectivity between how the frontal cortex communicates with the rest of the brain so that you have more control over redirecting your attention back to central executive network or back to task positive function rather than DMN. So you're kind of saying, yes, we know that this is more active, but we can pull it back. We can strengthen the central executive network through, you know, focusing on things like deep work, etc. Of course, the caveat is that we have to be motivated or primed, I think is the correct sort of way to describe it, to want to do work for an extended period of time. So, you know, removing distractions, starting small, you know, whether it's 5 minutes of focused work, because, you know, there are days where I sit down and I actually can't even do something for 5 minutes without thinking, oh, I need to check something, or I need to get up and make a coffee. You know, that's, those are those self-interruptions. And there was a study that was done, and unfortunately, they didn't differentiate between neurodivergent and neurotypical. They weren't purely neurotypical. There was a pool that was mixed. They just didn't specify, which is unfortunate. But it showed that 51% of our interruptions are self-governed, so they're self-initiated, which means that we'll sit down to work and we'll go, oh, I need to make that coffee. Oh, what about that email? Oh, the dog needs to do this.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, through things like meditation, which again, catch 22, because it requires quite a lot of focus to be able to drive that, not the quiet, because I think people have got meditation a bit twisted over the years, and rightly so. I think the wellness industry is just completely confused people, you know, but we can't be quiet. Our brains cannot be quiet.
That's really validating. Yeah, that's validating to hear. So, I mean, what would you say meditation-wise? I mean, I'd love to hear from a neuroscientist. What is the most effective for a neurodivergent brain?
I would say, so focusing on breath. So we have something called exteroception, which is you're sensing everything from the outside. And then we have interoception, which is, you know, thinking about your lungs expanding, thinking about your breath, thinking about how you feel internally. And doing something where you're introspective and checking on your senses from the inside. So maybe focusing on your breath going from top to bottom. I sort of visualize my breath going from toes all the way through to the top of my head, all the way back down. And the purpose of meditation is to allow thoughts to come in if they do, because they will. That's the way the thoughts work. They're spontaneous. They will arise at any point, and they should. That's how we're wired. But it's not attaching yourself to those thoughts. So if you think of the email, you don't go, oh my goodness gracious, and then you start going this whole route of why you didn't send the email or XYZ, or actually even worse, get up and send the email midway. It's about conflict resolution in the brain, which can then help you with conflict resolution in real life. So when you're sat down to do work and you've got a competing sound outside, you can then train your brain to redirect back to the task at hand.
Okay, that's really interesting. So you're talking about training our brains here. And this is what I love about the new findings we're hearing in neuroscience, because it's giving us all hope. And I think, you know, 20 years ago, 10 years ago even, and perhaps even 5 years ago, ADHD was very much like you're doomed. We see, unfortunately, addiction. We see a lot of the criminal justice system, a lot of people in social care, dysfunction, really serious mental health problems due to undiagnosed ADHD. People just not understanding why their brains are working the way they are. And, you know, I hear people say, oh, it's a superpower. It may well be a superpower when we're fully informed, fully aware, and have been given the tools, the medication, the help, the support. Then we can thrive. But before, it's just like, this is a hindrance. This is a real, this is like dragging me down and I can't do life. So in an ideal world, and no, there's no such thing, but how would our brains optimally thrive? Because the society is going against everything, you know, social media, this fast-paced way of life, stimuli coming at us at all things, especially women right now who are juggling everything. If we're sort of in traditional partnerships and looking after children and doing all the stereotypical things that women are expected to do, it just feels like society is not supporting us to live optimally. If we are now seeing so much neurodivergence and we're now understanding how that looks, for me, this is what I would say, but again, it's not the scientific backing. It's freedom, it's autonomy, it's being able to choose how and where you want to work, being able to bring in movement, being able to harness the power of sleep and good food and having downtime and good social connections and all of this. And it just kind of feels so simple, but actually this is what so many people are struggling with. And our brain isn't being able to get this sort of positive stimuli so we can thrive.
Yes. I would say self-alignment as well. You know, one of my biggest things is I see all these biohacks on the internet and wellness this and supplement that. And I always think, can you sit alone with yourself in a room and be okay? You know, because when you have self-trust, neurodivergent, neurotypical, you can get through most things in life. So when someone throws at you a reductive statement about neurodivergency and you're self-aligned, you can sort of deflect that and know that it's not, doesn't attach to your worth, as an example. And I think that that's a really important aspect of, you know, living, like you said, with freedom and living optimally, is understanding yourself so that you can then go through life, I think, a little bit easier. And now it's interesting you say that about, because I completely agree, and the world is working against people, right? And there was a paper that came out a couple of weeks ago, which was crazy. And they were saying that we're living in a brain negative economy. So everything that is supposed to be healthy for us is not accessible. Exercise is expensive. You have to go to and pay a gym membership. Of course, you can do exercise for free, you know, but that requires you to know what you're doing. And then there's so much misinformation on the internet. You start getting overwhelmed, confused. So, you know, I think it was saying that like a salad is $1.99 when a Big Mac was a dollar. And it was sort of comparing all these different things that are supposed to help us thrive in life. So we should feel optimal. We should sleep better. We should do all of these things to feel good. But the economy is not helping us in that respect, because you can buy £1 pepperoni pizza, whereas, you know, the things that should be healthier for you are inaccessible: organic meat, organic vegetables, etc. So I think the question is difficult to answer, but I think I'm aligned with everything you've said, you know, and trying your best to fit in what you can. So remove the excess. And what I mean is remove what you can't control and invite what you can. Can you control a sleep schedule that is maybe more complementary to your lifestyle? And again, I hate when people say you've got to get up at 6 a.m. to be productive and whatever. You know, everybody's different. But what the brain prefers is consistency. So if you're going to go to bed at 12 and wake up at 8, then that's fine. But make sure you do that every day. 12 to 8. If you go to bed at 10 and you wake up at 6, great. 10 to 6. But making sure that you're consistent with that well-being, sleep hygiene. One of my biggest hacks or tools is trying to not be on your phone for the first hour of the morning, because that really jacks up your dopamine. And the problem with that is that it then sort of sets you off on a trajectory for the rest of the day where you're in a reward-seeking type behavior. So I don't know if you've had it where you start social media too early. I can certainly resonate with this. And then by 3 o'clock, I'm like there kind of like a junkie scrolling like, oh my God, I can't get off social media. Or every 10 minutes I'm going, oh, what's my social media saying, you know? And it's weird. The more it's not weird. It makes total sense, but it's a matter of a different form of expression. But the earlier I start social media, the more I want to be on it in the afternoon. And we know that it increases dopamine early on in the day. It's one of the hardest habits, I must admit, to embark on, not being on your phone first thing in the morning and then limiting phone use late at night as well. So research shows that after 11 o'clock, it actually impacts the way that we create dopamine because it impacts an area of the brain called the habenula. Now, the habenula produces dopamine overnight. And when it is stimulated with artificial light in the times where your circadian rhythm should be sleeping, it disrupts that system, which means that dopamine is then impacted. Now, dopamine is not the only neurochemical at play in ADHD, but is one of the major driving forces. Now, an interesting fact on dopamine actually is it actually helps you to dilate or constrict time. It's one of the reasons why ADHDers might find themselves not having good time management. And that was really interesting. There's a paper that came out that basically attributed time dilation to dopamine, and dysfunctions in the dopamine system can mean that someone would either underestimate the time that something would take, yeah, or overestimate, which is, yeah, really, really interesting. And I don't know if you've ever had it, but when you're maybe like having a really good time, time goes by really quickly. Yeah. And that's exactly why, because that dopamine is really high.
Interesting. That's really, yeah, interesting. Yeah. I mean, listen, time blindness is a huge one. And actually, I was speaking to a client of mine only yesterday who is really impacted by her time blindness, and it really kind of internalizes a lot of shame for her because it impacts the way she parents, but also from a professional perspective. She says that, you know, if she gets to a meeting 6 minutes late, that kind of, for her, that just is everything about, you know, her self-worth and her, yeah, validation from her colleagues. And she just says she really, really struggles. And it's just something that she's still not managed to get a hold on. I mean, is there something from a neuroplasticity perspective that we can do about time and time blindness?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'll take it back to understanding. Once you understand, again, you said that perfectly, you said validation, you know, she feels shame. And when we understand mechanisms as to what's going on with us, we start to detach that personality type from what's going on. So all of a sudden, you don't think that, you know, you're the bad guy, you're the terrible person that has no time management. You start to understand why, and that can help you. That can help you to be, you know, maybe structure it better, maybe add on 6 minutes to everything that you do just in case. So my partner, he'll put his watch 10 minutes forward so that he's always on time because he's always late.
But the problem is with that, I've done that before, and then your brain clocks on because, oh, I know my watch is late. So, you know, you then kind of override the system a little bit.
Add on time maybe just in case to everything. And my kind of thing is always, I'd rather be early, right? So even if I've got to sort of sit there and read a book or play Sudoku. Some of the other tools that are aligned, I would say, is movement in the morning as well. So my top three kind of morning hacks for, you know, especially ADHDers is remove the phone first thing, if you can. I appreciate it is very hard, so I don't want anyone to feel rubbish about themselves. We're living in a world where we have a source of addiction at our fingertips. It's almost like, you know, telling a gambler he can only go and gamble for 1 hour a day. You know, it's not going to work. So, you know, you can only have one drink as an alcoholic. It's difficult to say that. So I can appreciate that the no phone thing is quite difficult. But another simple hack is hydration first thing in the morning. So you have not drunk any water for about 8 to 10 hours, right? Now, the brain is mostly water. Your body is mostly water, and it communicates in the presence of water. So we need to be hydrated. And research shows that even a 2% dehydration can have temporary sort of motor decline in everything that we do, and attention control as well, vigilance decrement. So how quickly we lose vigilance. And that's really interesting because most people will get up and drink coffee. And I was the same until I understood that actually we should really hydrate ourselves first and then caffeinate. Now, there'll be mixed reviews saying, you know, caffeinate 90 minutes later, wait 3 hours, etc. I say with anyone, especially ADHD, don't overcomplicate things, you know, take on what you can manage. Because I think, again, we live in this world where there's so much information, do this, do that. And I think you need to sort of take on what you can manage, and then we learn the best on positive reinforcement. So, oh, I did that right, tick. I feel good about myself. That releases dopamine in itself, and that's a snowball effect, because dopamine is a reward-based learning activity, neurochemical, which reinforces the activity that you've just done.
What you were saying then, which is interesting because it just shows how impactful sleep really is.
Sleep is fundamentally your biggest optimization tool. If you haven't got sleep under wraps, and I appreciate that people have got things going on, but if you have any control over it, I say take that by the horns and just really hone in on that, because sleep is responsible for clearing out all the toxins from the day. We have something called the glymphatic system, which basically removes toxic buildup from the brain, tau buildup, which can lead to Alzheimer's later in life as well, Parkinson's disease, dementia. And it also helps create new pathways. It aids neuroplasticity. The other thing is it helps consolidate memories. It also releases growth hormone, which is responsible for repairing not just brain cells, but bodily cells as well. And testosterone, which is hugely influential for our cognitive health, both women and men. So, you know, all these wonderful things that happen at night. And if, you know, if we're not really taking care of that, it can really have an impact. I think what I always come back to is education and knowledge and understanding. And what's really interesting, I was at the beach the other day, this is a bit of an anecdote, and I saw a bunch of teenagers all playing Uno at the beach, and I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. And George, my partner, he's Portuguese, he was saying, he's like, oh yeah, we've been doing that since we were kids. And I just thought that's so wonderful that they're not sitting there on their phone. So I would like to think that at some point, even children, even teenagers will catch on and go, this isn't right, this isn't healthy for us. I'd like to, maybe I'm being a bit
you're not, because I we've recently just come back from a multi-generational holiday for my mother-in-law's 80th. So we've got the ages were like 80 down, and it was with, we've got a big family, so loads of cousins from different ages, ranging from something like 27 down to 9. And we, most of us put our phones away, like we really did. It was so fun to have so many people there together. There was like 20 of us at some points, and everyone was talking and learning, and people were, you know, come from all different places around the world to kind of like celebrate. And what I noticed is that everyone was in a good mood. There was a lot of laughter, a lot of, you know, fun, talking, connection. And yeah. I felt, for me, I left my phone upstairs in the bedroom most of the time, and I felt much more relaxed, calm. Yes. There was a lot of people in the house. Sometimes it was a bit much, but actually I felt my nervous system was calmer because I had forgotten that there was this whole world of comparisons and clicks and likes and algorithms and to-dos and all the things that come with social media. You know, so many of us are working either for ourselves, or social media is like a massive part of our business. But I often get this feeling where I just want to shut the whole thing down. It's a beast. It's a monster that I just don't want to be part of anymore.
Yeah.
If I could do what I do without having to be on social media, I think I would feel more regulated. I would feel calmer, and I wouldn't have these rushes of cortisol and panic. And if I'm feeling this as a nearly 44-year-old woman who is pretty informed, what are the kids feeling? Like, what's a teenager who doesn't want to know about this now? Like, doesn't care about sleep, doesn't care about eating processed food. And I'm trying to be positive, and I'm trying to think that, like what you said, that they will come out of it. And what I think my point of the story was is that my kids notice that connecting away from their phones and being around the table and talking and hearing stories and anecdotes, that was really powerful for them. And they realize that what they get from that is much more than what they get from their phones.
Yes, and I've got goosebumps.
And I really hope that this is what stays with them for life, because they saw that this is how humans should be.
Yes, exactly. And fundamentally, we are social beings. We get so much reward from connecting with people. It's the basis of, you know, being a human is we need other people. To, you know, research shows that we can spend up to around 75% of our time alone. And it's about the quality of connections, not the quantity. But we still need to be connected. And when we do connect with people, like you would have at, the, like you said, the dinner table and communicating and hearing anecdotes, it releases surges of neurochemicals that you can't really get in any other way. You know, it's a cocktail of oxytocin, vasopressin, serotonin, dopamine, all these wonderful feelings that would be hard to sort of mimic in any other way. And social media is, the brain is not designed to, so when we go through the world, your eyes are directing everything. So you're flowing through the system where you're going from the bedroom to the kitchen, and the eyes are, you know, picking up all of this movement, knowing that you're shifting through the world. When you're on your phone, you're jumping from the Maldives to, I don't know, the Bahamas, to England, to some funny guy in their living room, to, you know, and it's all very great, but the brain doesn't really fully understand or grasp the concept of what's going on. And it can be very overwhelming and very stimulating, which can, you know, leave, again, increase cortisol. 100% does increase cortisol. It 100% does increase our stress hormones. But, you know, I also think that we can curate our social medias to be more nurturing, in the sense that I, for example, only follow now educational accounts, inspirational and funny stuff as well. I'm not a complete Scrooge. memes and stuff, but I don't really get that kind of, like, and this is no disrespect, I'm just using this as an example, but like girl on the yacht living her best life, I don't really get that kind of content on my social media anymore. And, you know, kudos to them, but it would make me feel, I think it would actually make me feel like, hey, but I wouldn't want to be seeing that all the time. So I think one of the steps in the book is spring clean your social media. So if you have little control over, you know, the situation, and, you know, I think we can all admit that we have little control in the sense of how much time we spend on it. Ideally, in an ideal world, it would be less addictive and we would, you know, say only 2 hours a day. But I don't know. I know my screen time is a lot, and it's my job as well. So, but what I have control over is who I follow, who I engage with, and what I see. So I will sort of say no to the things that I don't want to see. And now my Instagram is actually wonderfully curated.
See, that's really powerful. And that leads me on to actually something that I wanted to finish with, because I wanted to finish with something quite powerful and uplifting. And that is being able to use our brains to visualize and to kind of use it as an amazing tool for creating and desiring and really honing in on what's important to us, and being able to kind of filter out the noise. So, you know, we talk about manifestation, we talk about kind of like the power of visualization and calling things to us. But what I'd like to know is, from a neuroscience perspective, we've got something from, I think I'm right in saying it's the reticular activating system. And when we use that to our benefit, we can hone in, and which is why a lot of people say, you know, vision boards or action boards can be very powerful. What's your take on that?
Yes, I alluded to it earlier when I was talking about how we have information in our periphery, and if you choose to focus on the negative, that's everything you're going to see. So, you know, if I said to you now, Kate, how many blue things are in your room right now? And you start looking at all the blue things, and I say, okay, great, how many red things were there? You didn't pay attention to the red things. You were only looking for the blue things. And that's kind of how this vision board and manifestation works. If you've got your eyes on a goal and you're blocking out everything else, you're not going to see the other stuff. You're just going to be focusing on what you want, which means that it will then also be amplified from your environment. So you see something else that then confirms your bias around what you want. So there's so much science around it, and we know that it can rewire parts of the cerebellum, which is responsible for motor function. So athletes that would practice, say, a golf shot, for example, in their mind, would then be able to execute it even better when it came to it. So we know that visualization is grounded in data. We can also sort of create pathways through thought alone. So there was a wonderful study done in 1995. This was kind of like the basis of, oh, okay, our thoughts are pretty powerful and can create synapses, is Dr. Pasquale Leone took two groups of individuals. He told one group to imagine that they were playing a five-finger piece on the piano. They had never played the piano before. And he told the other group, again, who had never played the piano before, to learn the five-finger piece, actually physically use their hands. And both groups had similar levels of plasticity in the motor cortex, which is amazing. So they basically saw and realized that through thought, we can start to prime that area, the motor cortex, in response to how your hand is then going to move, which is, I don't know, it blew my mind when I read that study. And so basically, the way that visualization works is it helps to kind of create a blueprint for what it is that you want, because the brain also likes to keep us safe. So I actually can resonate with that. I have a client in New York who would really like to live by the beach. But before we started working together, it was almost like impossible for her to think that, because her job is in New York. Her life is in New York. She was born in New York. And it takes a lot to think about wanting to live in, say, Miami, for example. But through visualizing, she has started to kind of see what life would be like. So you're teaching your brain and body how you could feel in a place like that, so that you can start to assimilate your life with something else. Because the brain wants to keep you safe, and it wants to keep you where you are. Even if where you are doesn't align with you anymore, it would prefer the known, the comfort of the known, versus the fear of the unknown, even if the fear of the unknown is better. And that's generally why people also tend to stay in toxic relationships, because the fear of the unknown is sometimes worse than the comfort of the known. And the brain doesn't know the difference between right and wrong. Not really. Our conscious brain can tell us morally, but on a neurobiological level, whatever's been repeated is the sequence of events that it's going to take every time, the path more traveled. And it's only when we start breaking out of that and creating new pathways that we can start moving towards a different future. And through visualization, we can start priming that pathway to say, okay, this is the route we've always taken, but what if we actually went this way? And how would you feel if you started going down this way? So when you start doing it, it's not as scary. And it slowly you can kind of move towards this new version or new place.
Yeah, and I guess that's why we see family like generational cycles repeating, don't we? Because it's what we see and what we know. And like you say, even though it's horrendous what we're experiencing, sometimes the unknown is even scarier. Of like, what would it look like if I didn't choose a partner like that was like that? Or I did think about, I mean, we see that sort of like financial and money mindset, that it's really scary to think about, well, what would it be like if I did earn X and I've never seen that being earned in my family before? I guess with visualization, would you say it's kind of the softer, we're sort of like bedding ourselves in, we're telling our brain it's safe, and we're just kind of like trying it out and kind of telling our nervous system it's safe, that it's okay to think about something different. Because like you say, your client in New York is not going to jump on a flight to Miami the next day, and because that would be very dysregulating and probably combust. Like, just
Yes, I actually have a chapter or a step in the second phase of the book where I say, you know, little by little does the trick. So you can either go through this fear and slowly teach your body that you're safe, or you can jump in the deep end. You know, I don't recommend that way, but some people can do that. It's the reason why people sort of shave their head, pack their bags, and go and travel travel the world. And that's great, but that doesn't work for every single situation. You know, you can't just quit your job. But yes, so visualization can really open up that possibility for you.
So if someone's listening right now and they don't work with a coach, but they are listening to this and they're thinking, I really want to make a change. And how would you someone go about doing this on their own without being guided? And would you say an action board or a visualization board is something to start with?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that question, also because there are individuals with a neurodivergency called aphantasia.
Yes.
I don't know. Okay,
exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, but please explain what it is so people know.
Yes, Yes, so aphantasia is the inability to visualize imagery in your mind. So if I said to you, can you imagine a red apple in your brain or in your mind, people with aphantasia would not really be able to. They think more abstractly. So what they would probably benefit from is either having a vision board that they can look at or visualizing in a step-by-step process in a journaling system. Again, I've got that example in my book, but, you know, saying, okay, I want to move to Miami and live on the beach. This is how I would feel. This is the step I'm going to take. And kind of just step-by-step processing how you could get to that point. To make it a little bit of an easier example, you can also visualize like new habits. So for example, if you want to start running in the morning, you could visualize the night before yourself going to bed, waking up, turning off the alarm, knowing you're going to be tired and you want to turn it off, deciding you're not going to do that, turn off the alarm anyway, get out of bed, put on your shoes, put on your clothes, and step out of the door. By visualizing those steps, it is then easier for you to execute those. So with individuals who have aphantasia, they could write those steps down. Wake up. I know I'm going to want to snooze. Don't snooze. Press the alarm. Get out of bed. And all those steps, which seems very pragmatic and like analytical, but it does work. And then with bigger sort of future visualizations, things like, you know, like vision boarding, if you're someone who prefers to do it with a meditation, I love to put like really woo-woo music on and I like get deep into it. Breathing, doing some breath work and just slowing down your central nervous system and then kind of imagining what your life is going to be like. Dr. David Spiegel is a psychiatrist at Stanford, and he does visualizations where he gets his patients to imagine that they've got like a sort of movie screen. And then what do they want is on that movie screen. And then he sort of talks you through all the different ways to feel how you would feel. But asking yourself how you feel, how you can get there. And it might be a process, you know, in the beginning, it's maybe just kind of like flirting with the idea. And then the next time you visualize, it's, you know, flirting with how you're going to get to the point. And then maybe by the end of the month, it's what are the steps involved in getting there? So,
yeah.
It's something that has to be done on a regular basis. So that's the thing I would say is the brain wants repetition. So even if it's 5 minutes, do it every day or at least every second day.
Yeah. So consistency and repetition, which, yes. I mean, with consistency, it can be hard with ADHD. But what we do know is that it can really help when we build these habits and we build on them. And if they work for us, even if they look strange to other people, it can really, really help. And then we can, like you say, flirt with ideas of like, if it's getting boring, we can kind of change things up. But essentially, if we're building these healthy habits with consistency, whether we walk one day or we swim the other day or, you know, but I think you're right, the sleep thing, the hydration, the consistency, removing the phone, the self-alignment and the self-trust. I think this is just building foundational tools to living and thriving well with ADHD and having lots of self-compassion.
One of the things I wanted to just add to that list as well is we spoke about meditation, which I know is really difficult. There's a wonderful paper done and they basically looked at 17 minutes of third eye meditation where people just focus on a third eye, that interoception feeling again. And there was neuroplasticity in the frontal cortex in one 17 minute session alone. Fine. That was a guided meditation, which I can appreciate is easier, but start small, add on. So my three steps to the morning routine are hydrate, leave the phone alone, and then either movement or meditation. So one of those things which can help you start your day on the front foot.
Can I just ask very quickly when you say about movement and meditation, am I right in saying that when we walk, and I do a lot of walking, it's kind of like not EMDR, but where you're moving the right to the left and it's the eye. Can you just explain that very quickly?
Absolutely. Yeah. Again, I love talking about this one, but we have when we're moving through the world, there are images coming through your periphery. You're not actively looking side to side, but your eyes will be detecting movement and thus moving laterally. And that lateral eye movement competes for resources with the amygdala. So the orbitofrontal cortex is activated, which means that the amygdala, which is sort of more in the temporal lobe, is switched switched off or less active, if you will, which means that you can process thoughts, feelings and emotions without that fear attached to them. And the paper that they where they figured this out, it was interesting because in the discussion section, they wrote there, they said, I think we just accidentally figured out, obviously not in these terms, it was more scientific than that, but they did say that they think they just accidentally figured out how EMDR works, because we know EMDR works, we just never really knew the mechanism. So it was really interesting paper.
That is interesting. And listen, we've known forever that going on a walk is always going to help. You know, we say, go on a walk, take some space, have a think. We always come back with some form of solution or resolution after a walk. No matter what, I always feel better after a walk. I've never come back from a walk feeling worse.
Yes, exactly.
And so that just, I love the fact that we have known all this forever, but science is like backing the ancient wisdom, you know, all the stuff that we've just, we've known intrinsically. I think this has been a really fascinating conversation, Nicole.
And thank you.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you so much. And yeah, tell people how, you know, if they want to work with you, contact you, what's the best way?
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram, Nicole's Neuroscience. So Nicole's with an S. So it's like my neuroscience, Nicole's Neuroscience.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, because everyone types Nicole Neuroscience. Well, now people are calling me Nicole Neuroscience. Someone actually thought it was my surname and I was like, that's so sweet. No, it's not.
That would have been really handy.
Yeah, I know. My website is nicolesneuroscience.com and I've got my book coming out, Rewire. I have explained some mechanisms of ADHD in a side note, but it does, all of these things that we've spoken about are in the book. You can read about them.
I can't wait to get your book, and I'm really excited to be able to share this conversation, and hopefully it'll be very helpful to lots of people.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I honestly could have sat here forever chatting to you. Thank you.
I really hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you did and it resonated with you, I would absolutely love it if you could share on your platforms or maybe leave a review and a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. And please do check out my website, adhdwomenswellbeing.co.uk, for lots of free resources and paid for workshops. I'm uploading new things all the time and I would absolutely love to see you there. Take care and see you for the next episode.